Welcome back to another Talkin' Lamar Christmas edition. On this episode, we talk about all kinds of Christmas tradition, things like trees, eggnog, Yule log, all things Christmas, and where exactly they came from.
What are you talking about?
What are you talking about?
Sorry, I forgot what I was talking about.
What are you talking about?
I am talking to you.
That's just what I was talking about.
It's Talkin' Lamar.
What a great time of the year. What an absolute wonderful time of the year. It doesn't get any better than this. And there's so many things that we celebrate and so many traditions that we have. So I started looking into a few of them to see exactly where they got started. So the first thing we're going to talk about is Christmas trees. Now, Germany first introduced decorated trees in the Middle Ages, but the custom spread to America by the early 19th century. A New York woodsman named Mark Carr is credited with opening the first U.S. Christmas tree lot in 1851. A survey they did back in 2019 by the American Christmas Tree Association predicted that 77% of U.S. households displayed a Christmas tree of some sort in their home. Among the trees on display, an estimated 81% were artificial, and 19% were real. I'm a little shocked by that. Are y'all?
By how many are artificial?
The ratio, yeah.
You know, I too am a little surprised. I have no fight with an artificial tree. Kev doesn't want one. I would like to have a pink or silver one myself, but he insists on a real tree. Listen, I wonder.
I love an artificial tree.
That's everybody that has them loves them. I wonder, and you may know this. Like, who was the first brave soul who said, you know what the world needs? A fake Christmas tree. And everyone said, no, that'll never work. And then, you know,
the rest
is history, Boston Hill.
I used to be real tree. But after so many Christmases of my kids watching out the window while I'm out there trying to saw the bottom off so it fits into the tree stand and not being able to get the tree stand, and cussing it out and raising Cain and then dragging it into the house, getting it to stand upright, then it's my job to put the lights on. Putting on the lights on the Christmas tree, it's a horrible, horrible job. I learned the trick that once you get some of them on, you step back and you squint your eyes and you can tell where the spots are that you need to move them around. But I hate it. Then I went to the artificial tree, and I went back and forth over the time, artificial, real. But I go to the artificial tree, and you get a really good one that's already got the lights on it. That's the key. It's already got the lights. Then when you drag it out, you got to fluff it out because it's all cankered up. You know what I'm saying? It's all packed into that box. So you got to fluff it out and get all the stuff, the needles and stuff and all that. And then one year, a section of the lights goes out. So you throw a string on, and the next year another section goes out. The next thing you know, you put lights on the artificial tree. That's the whole reason you bought it, was not to put the lights on the artificial tree. But I solved that problem by going to Costco, because Costco has lights on the tree, and they're unfluffable. They're no fluff. It's a no fluff tree. You just take it out, you put it up, and it sets up, and it looks fantastic.
And how can there be a no-fluff tree? How can that?
It's a no-fluff. It's a no-fluff tree. And it's got colored lights. It's got white lights. And you can turn it on so that the colored lights dim down and the white lights come on and it goes back. There's like 20 different settings. It's just, it's magical.
Did you get like a 55-gallon drum of eggnog with that?
Only because I'm not an egg drunk. But, you know, we talked. The more I research eggnog, and I have got it. Later on, I'll give you the exact George Washington recipe for eggnog. So I feel like maybe I need to go back and try it again. I'm not sure.
I'm surprised not really sure that you're not an eggnog man. Because it's so. Here's why. I don't think you have the world's biggest sweet tooth. It's not that. It's just this incredibly rich, indulgent tradition. And you seem like the kind of man to put on a Christmas sweater and pour some eggnog down his pie hole. I'm so surprised.
I know. I think my first taste of eggnog was not fun. I didn't like it. Whoever made it, I just assumed that's what it all tastes like. I haven't tried it since. So,
oh, it's good. Good stuff.
I got to try it again. Got to try it again.
We are so excited about Bob and Sherry Premium. Well-marbled, juicy, and always fresh with loads of behind-the-scenes photos and videos, exclusive content, including our classic chat room calls and our best-of CDs. And best of all, it's just $4.99 a month. BobandSherry.com/premium.
One of my greatest Christmas traditions is watching a Charlie Brown Christmas. I love it. I absolutely love it. And all these decades later, it's probably hard to imagine that this beloved TV special that was inspired by Charles Schulz's Peanut comic strip was first rejected by CBS executives. They didn't want nothing to do with it. After they showed it to them, they didn't get the voices, because all the voices, they were voiced by children. They didn't get that. They didn't get the music or how it was paced. And they were sure it was going to be an absolute disaster. But the problem is they already had it on the schedule. And they said, we're going to show this one time and be done with it. So it finally aired on December the 9th, 1965. Almost half of all the TVs in the country, over 15 million, were tuned in to the broadcast. The show went on to win an Emmy. It won a Peabody. It's got a huge following. It even created a trend of Charlie Brown Christmas trees. I never thought it was such a bad little tree, Linus says in that special. It's not bad at all, really. Maybe it just needs a little love. I watch this every year. I never miss it, along with Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and the original When the Grinch Stole Christmas. I mean, I love those things. And I think the Charlie Brown Christmas is just huge. It's huge. I love it. Absolutely.
Lamar,
love it.
I am not even a little bit surprised that the programming executives at CBS didn't get it.
Oh, yeah.
I think if people knew the extent to which the folks who make decisions for what you get to listen to or read or watch, if you knew like how cynical and contemptuous of you a lot of those folks are, not all of them, but a lot of them, you'd be so pissed you might not watch anything or listen to anything ever again.
Well, see, this was at the time when you only had three channels. And so you had three gatekeepers, basically, three gatekeepers deciding what you saw. Now, there's so many different ways to watch that if you've got something that's a little weird, there's a place to show it. You know what I'm saying? You want to be a little bit out of the box, there's somebody that will stream it or show it or whatever. And it has really gave us another level of entertainment. I mean,
but despite some of the quirky things about that, there is something that's resonated with people about it, even though there wasn't much else to watch. I mean,
they loved it. They loved
the jazz music. Charlie Brown is suffering from some sort of depression.
Yeah.
I think that's what the decision makers struggled with, was that the pacing, like when you think about the Peanuts comics, just on the printed page, but now think about the TV versions, the pacing of it is measured and slow. It doesn't have that frantic Saturday morning cartoon vibe, right?
No.
And the children in the Charlie Brown universe are not very childlike. Charlie Brown has depression and lives in a full-blown existential crisis. Yep. Lucy's has no...
Taking advantage of that.
Yeah. Linus is a 60-year-old man in a child's body. You know, think about it. And then the Snoopy? I can see how they were just bewildered by it. But it just goes to show you that don't assume that everything you see is the best that was available to show you. Because a lot of really great stuff never gets past those gatekeepers.
Yep, that's exactly right. Now, here's one that I was not familiar with, and probably maybe you will be, but I was not. Christmas pickles. If there's a pickle among your snowman or your angel and reindeer ornaments, you're likely taking part in the American tradition of hiding the green pickle ornament on the tree so that the first child to find it either wins a gift or gets to open the first present on Christmas morning. how this started is a little bit murky, but it likely grew from a Woolworth's marketing gimmick from the late 1800s. The retailer received this huge amount of imported German ornaments, and they were shaped like a pickle, and it had to get rid of them. So it needed a sales pitch to get rid of them. So they sort of invented that tradition, if you hear, to sell their pickles. And they, it caught on. Cool. I mean, it,
no, it's cynical. It is pretty cool. It's cynical AF, you know, but the fact that it became a charming tradition is pretty cool.
Once again, trace it back to the money. It's always the money. Yeah. Elf on the Shelf. If you love it or you hate it. Since 2005, moms and dads have either been happy or begrudging or whatever, but they have been hiding a toy elf each night from Thanksgiving to Christmas, and more than 13 million elves have been adopted since 2005 when Carol Ebersold and her daughter, Chanda Bell, published the book Elf on a Shelf, A Christmas Tradition. It comes with the toy. Social media has even inspired parents to set up elaborate scenarios for their elves, like he TP'd the tree or she filled the sink with marshmallows. Now Snoop Dogg and Martha Stewart, they're in on the gig. So it still keeps getting cooler and cooler. I don't see the Elf on the Shelf going anywhere. I really don't. I really don't.
I did when my girls were little, we did Elf on the Shelf. I had many years where we did advent calendars, Elf on the Shelf. And my girls went to a language immersion magnet school, so we also did Hanukkah and Kwanzaa and a handful of other traditions from around the world. And I'm here to tell you, I would skid into Christmas morning on fire and exhausted from all of that. And the Elf on the Shelf, see, here's the thing. The Elf on the Shelf was the worst, and I'll tell you why. As everyone knows, you can't touch the Elf on the Shelf with your hands or you'll mess with his or her magic. So the Elf on the Shelf has to be moved. If the children witness you moving the Elf on the Shelf, you have to use oven mitts or barbecue tongs or whatever. But the Elf on the Shelf can't move until everyone goes to bed at night when the elf flies back to the North Pole and snitches get stitches, Mr. Peppermint. Yep. But, you know, you rats on all of us. And woe to you if your elf forgets to go to the North Pole, Lamar, if you know what I mean. Your elf, maybe it was a real busy Wednesday night and your elf forgot to go to the North Pole. And then the next day,
that's a problem.
Your child, maybe your child's name is, I don't know, Karamia, bursts into tears. Did Kevin touch the elf and kill him? The number of times that I pitched him under the wheels and said, "Oh, honey, oh, yes. I'm sorry. I think Kevin touched the elf."
Somebody's got to take the blame.
Someone's got to take the fall.
Yeah. It's funny how you mentioned advent calendars. Early versions of this tradition started in Germany in like 1903 by publisher Gerhard Land. He offered a way for children to count down to Christmas by opening one door or one window a day to reveal a Bible passage or a poem or a small gift. Since gaining this mass popularity by 1920, the calendars have evolved to secular calendars that include daily gifts of all kinds of stuff. You got 12 days of instant noodles. You've got 12 days of luxury ornaments. You've even got an Ann Summers sexual wellness advent calendar. You got happy socks. This is one for Kevin. You have a tool-a-day calendar. There's a retro radio calendar that gives you one part every day so you build an actual radio. And my personal favorite, the gin and tonic advent calendar. It's all kinds of different tonics and all kinds of different gins along the way.
Lamar, can I tell you that since you're talking about advent calendars, so an actor that I follow on Instagram, she was in the first season of White Lotus, and she's in Mayfair, the Mayfair Witches, Alexandria Daddario. She was on Baywatch. I was about to say Best Buy. She was not on Best Buy. She was on Baywatch. Anyway, so I guess She has some sort of brand partnership with the French fashion house Dior. And she was like, my Dior advent calendar has arrived. And it's like this enormous, exquisite looking thing. So, of course, my curiosity got the best of me. I had to know. $750.
Whoa.
$750. So I went ahead and I had some, I had a look at some of the reviews. Tasha says, quote, I purchased this for myself. The packaging is beautiful, but it's not worth the price for all the sample size items. Girl, it was $750. Like, don't you feel guilty if while you're Christmas shopping, you buy yourself a t-shirt? Here's another one. This isn't worth the money. Too many little candles and perfumes that smell nasty. This was a terrible experience. $750. What did you think you were getting for $750? Okay, back to Advent.
Yes.
Now, this is something that I've never been familiar with, the Yule log. Yule logs were part of an ancient winter solstice celebration, but it was Americans who turned the wood burning into a must-see TV type thing. Back in 1966, WPIX-TV in New York City aired a continuous 17-second loop of a fireplace for 3 hours along with holiday music. That led to eventual better production, and now there's 20 year, after 20 years of viewing, you can watch the Yule log on demand on the web. Now, the original Yule log, during the winter solstice, they would cut down this big tree and make this big log and drag it into the house and stick one end of it into the fireplace and set it on fire. And as the log burned, they would push the log in. I don't know how many houses must have burnt down over this. I'm not sure. I mean, it just seems to me like it's a dangerous thing.
It does sound rough. It does.
So honestly, watching it on YouTube seems to be a whole lot safer, if I'm not wrong. Now, I never got into this. Ugly Christmas sweaters. Mm. Are y'all ugly Christmas sweater people?
I have a collection of truly epic Christmas cat sweaters that, yeah. I mean, I just can't help but have. I only wear them once a year, but yeah.
That's not the same as the ugly sweater thingies. I mean, you have them, but there's a theme to it. This is just ugly.
Lamar, you don't have a single Christmas sweater?
You know what? I do not. And you would think I would, but I just never got caught up in it.
Can I tell you?
I'm shocked.
My mother gave me a Christmas sweater that had like a deer and a Christmas tree on it, right?
Yeah, deer's so big on Christmas.
Guess
sweater.
What? Yeah. Not too many opportunities to wear this. But my mother would always ask me about it, interestingly enough. Do you still have that sweater? Somehow she was really proud of giving that to me. I wore it many Christmases. Yeah.
We can blame our Canadian neighbors for this tradition. It really gained steam in the 80s. According to the Ugly Christmas Sweater Party Book, sweaters became a party trend in Vancouver, Canada in 2001. And the trend looks like it's not going anywhere. According to Fox Business, the ugly sweater industry is now a multi-million dollar business with websites such as Tipsy Elves and different ones and retailers with Macy's and Kohl's and Target jumping on this bandwagon. At one point when it first started out, you know, the only place to find a Christmas sweater was at the Salvation Army or Goodwill. And then once it got started, they were all gone. I mean, you know what I'm saying? It just became almost impossible. And then people started making them and making them ugly. So now you can go online. You have all the choices that you want. I don't know. I just never got into it.
Am I the only person that's sitting here like completely shocked that Lamar does not have a Christmas sweater and he doesn't have some eggnog by the fire? What in the world? I'm so surprised.
I'm letting a lot of people down. I'm letting a lot of people down. But, you know, maybe when I try my eggnog this year, I'll get a sweater and do both things at the same time. Maybe I'll do that.
Maybe for the, for our Christmas tree lighting that we do on the Bob and Sherry show, maybe you could show up for that with some eggnog and a reindeer sweater. Planting the seed. There you go.
Planting the seed. Okay, here's a tradition: cookies and milk for Santa. Well, it's pretty simple. I assume this tradition started when people realized that the least they could do for somebody that once a year stops at your house, comes in and brings presents while you're asleep, is to leave a few cookies and a cold glass of milk. This is a hardworking guy. I mean, this is no mystery. I'm surprised it took that long.
Not only took the cookies and the milk, but he would write a note to us.
Oh, yeah. Yep. That's pretty nice. That really is pretty nice.
Sometimes Santa always ate the cookies the girls left out. And sometimes we would find glittery reindeer tracks on the sidewalk leading up to the house. Those were exciting.
That's cool. That's very, very cool. That's very cool. All right. Candy canes. Now, whether you devour them as a treat or you hang them on a tree as a decoration, candy canes are the number one selling non-chocolate candy during December. Now, these date back to 1670 in Germany. A priest wanted to keep the kids quiet during the service because people get, how the kids get tired and, can't be still. So he wanted to give them some candy to keep them occupied. So, and he felt like he had to, just handing out candy to kids, he had to add something to it. So he looked at it, the red stripes that they had, they represent the blood of Jesus. The white stripes represent the purity of Christ. And then the J, he had them bend it into a J shape, and that represents the name of Jesus. Now, they arrived in America in 1847 when a German-Swedish immigrant in Worcester, Ohio, placed them on a tree. And by the 1950s, somebody had come up with an automated candy cane-making machine, and, buddy, it took off then. And because they could make tons of them, and, I do love a candy cane. I do. I like a candy cane. So
I like a candy cane.
Yeah.
Like a singular.
I don't like a bunch of them.
Candy cane.
But I have one, and I do like it. I do like it. Now, what we've been talking about earlier, boozy eggnog, all right? Everybody says nothing makes the holidays like a glass of spiked eggnog. But this Yuletide cocktail stems from posset. I don't know how you pronounce it. It's a drink made a drink made from hot curdled milk and ale or wine from medieval England. That's where it started. And American colonists get credit for making it popular and adding rum to it because rum was cheap. They could get a hold of rum and it was cheap, and that's what they did. I've never been a fan, but George Washington had a special recipe: 12 eggs, half a cup of sugar, a fifth of bourbon, a half a teaspoon of salt, a quart of whipping cream, a cup of milk, and one or two teaspoons of nutmeg. Now, he really added the liquor to it. And I think we had talked about this before. It was a tough one. Listen, if you could drink his eggnog, you was a man. I mean, he made it strong. It was very, very strong. Woo! And I've got the actual recipe with directions. And we'll post this on the website if you want to give it a shot. Whatever. I'm just not sure about it. I'm just not the egg.
We need to post it, though.
Because this is supposed to be this is a famous recipe, and he's the one that came up with this exact recipe. So, now, do you have door wreaths on your house? Do you have wreaths on your doors?
I have. I just hung a wreath on my front door, yeah.
Well, they've been around since the ancient Greek and Roman times. But the evergreen Christmas wreath, often adorned with boughs of holly, it eventually took on a Christian meaning with a circular shape representing eternal life, and the holy leaves, and the holly leaves and the berries are symbolic of Christ's crown and the thorns and Christ's blood. But today's wreaths, which come in every kind of variety, you can get a Christmas wreath. There's no limit. There's just no limit. I mean, you get flowers, you got fruit, you got the glass balls, you got ribbons, you've got college teams, pro team. I mean, you've got every possible, you can get a wreath for anything that you want to. That's big, big business, big business.
Now, I saw, and I'll never forget it as long as I live, and I hope someday to be the kind of person who has this kind of time on her hands. This was a Martha Stewart creation that I saw Martha do on TV. That's how long ago, and it stuck with me. Yeah. So you go to the grocery store and you get you many, many bags of fresh, raw Ocean Spray cranberries. Lamar, I know you don't know where cranberry sauce comes from other than a can, but it's made from cranberries, which grow in bogs. And you can actually buy... Get ready. Woo, I hope you're sitting down. You can buy cranberries that don't have the seams of a metal can on them. So anyway.
I don't know how you know how to cut it, but that's your business. I mean,
You go to Michael's and you get you a styrofoam ring. Then you go to the grocery store and get many, 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 many bags of fresh raw cranberries. And you get a big container of straight pins. And then you go home and you spend... I don't even know how much time this would take, but you put a straight pin in each cranberry and then you insert that cranberry into that styrofoam ring until that entire ring is covered in cranberries. Then you slap a green ribbon on, or a gold ribbon or whatever kind of ribbon on that bad boy and hang it on your front door. And Martha said that unless you live in a really hot climate, that you don't have to worry about the cranberries rotting. They'll make it right through the festive season. Dude. What would you give to have that kind of time?
They sell those things every... I mean, I'm sorry. That's a lot. I can't even imagine. I cannot even imagine. Now, we determined, do you send out Christmas cards?
You know, in years past, I have. I admit I've dropped the ball since COVID. It's just, I don't know. It gets away from me. How about you?
Well... We do, but it's not even anywhere close to time. Carly never sends them out till the 23rd. I mean, she starts talking about it in November, but we never get them together until the 23rd. But the first official Christmas card was in 1843 in England, and it had this simple message, a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to you. And it gradually caught on in both Britain and the U.S., and then they started, you know, packaging them with an envelope, and I know you're going to be shocked at this. The Hall Brothers, which is now Hallmark, they created the folded card with the envelope in 1915. And today, according to the Greeting Card Association, more than 1.6 billion holiday cards are sold annually. Now, let's not even talk about the racket they have with Valentine's Day, Mother's Day, Boss's Day, and all the other days. Hallmark is killing it. Killing it, killing it, killing it. I mean.
And it hasn't really, people thought, one of the predictions with the internet was, oh, it's the end of the greeting card industry. And as best I can tell, it hasn't been the end of the greeting card industry. It just gave the greeting card industry a reason to charge like between $4 and $7 for a single greeting card.
Oh my gosh. I tell you what I did years and years ago. Carla and I finally, because I go, you buy a gift and then you go get the card and you're going, oh my gosh. So my point was, forget the card. If you want to write a little something on a piece of paper, something. Now, I'm not spending $7 or $8 on a card. I mean, that's, I'm just not doing it. I'm not. That's just, it's nuts. It's nuts.
Now, I remember the first time we realized this, Max's mom, may she frolic in the fields of heaven. Max's mom, the one thing in this world that mattered to her was a greeting card for an occasion sent through the mail with an actual stamp.
Yeah.
You could have dug Elvis up from his grave and had him sing you on her doorstep, and she'd go, that was nice, honey, but you didn't send me a card?
Yep.
Like, all she wanted was a card. And I can't remember if it was Mother's Day or her birthday one year, but Max comes into the studio and goes, do you know what greeting cards cost? Because it had been like $8.
It is
that
nuts.
Was the
it
is nuts. He was the canary in the coal mine. He was the first person to catch that I saw.
I mean, it's crazy. It is crazy. And you can go something. Listen, go to the dollar store. You know what they sell them for? A dollar. It don't a say dollar. Hallmark on it, but it's a dollar.
Well, if we dress the schnauzers in sweaters and do it at the drugstore, and it's actually cheaper than buying the cards.
Oh, yeah. No question. Yeah.
Now, when it comes to watching movies at Christmas time, Frank Capra's got the classic. OK, Okay. It is the classic with Jimmy Stewart playing George Bailey. It's a Wonderful Life. You know, he's a suicidal man who is shown what life would be like without him by an angel. But before becoming an annual TV viewing tradition, the movie, when they released it, it flopped at the box office. I mean, nobody
went
to see
it. I've heard that. And we don't know really why. Is there a theory why it tanked?
I don't know, because it received five Oscar nominations. It didn't win, but it had five nominations. But people just didn't go see it.
You know, it was Jimmy Stewart's first movie after he came back from World War II. And if you notice in it, he's really thin. He said it was his favorite movie he ever did. And Frank Capra said it was his favorite movie. So there were a lot of people that liked this movie. And I don't know if they didn't market it right or what exactly happened with it, that it was such a flop at the box office. But of course, it was when the trademark ran out on it.
Yeah. Somebody forgot to redo the copyright in the 70s, and that allowed TV stations to air it for free. So, you know, if they're going to get to do it for free, they're going to put it on there. And it has aired exclusively on NBC and USA since 1994. It's not my favorite. Miracle on 34th Street, starring Edmund Gwynn and Natalie Wood. That is my favorite. Well, that's of the black and white movies. That's my favorite. I think Elf has become my, I don't know. I didn't watch Elf twice this year.
Elf is one of my,
probably watch,
I could watch Elf all year long. Like, it's not even a Christmas movie for me. I love Elf.
Yeah, it's just great. It is great. Now, Christmas lights, Thomas Edison, he invented the light, but it was his partner and friend, Edward Heber Johnson, who had the bright idea of putting bulbs on strings and wrapping it around a Christmas tree in New York in 1882. By 1914, the lights were being mass-produced, and now we buy 150 million sets of lights each year in this country. I think that's because the 150 million we bought last year gets tangled up, and you can't get it, so you just throw the dang things away and start all over again. But this, again, is exactly about my Costco tree. I don't have to worry about all that. But God, that was my most hated thing. And I've put lights on the bushes in the front, but I've never put lights on the gutters and all around the house. I've just never done that. That seems like a lot.
I don't like putting lights on a Christmas tree. I like taking lights off a Christmas tree, which I know is the strangest.
What?
Yeah. Like, when it comes time to undecorate the Christmas tree, I have to set the afternoon aside. I put on some music or a Hallmark channel. I make myself a seasonally festive cocktail. And I climb up that ladder, and I will spend hours on lighting a Christmas tree.
And you save
the Capricorn in me. And I save the lights, yeah.
Yeah, because I think someone who works on the Bob and Sherry show just throws the lights out.
I can't do that. It's wasteful. I have so many Christmas lights that have you ever seen people that go up on their roof and they just go back and forth strand after strand? And then when they turn the entire roof of their house,
yes.
I have enough Christmas lights to do that, because what happens every year, like, I have carefully saved and coiled and tested every light strand from last year, hashtag Capricorn. But my husband forgets that. Hashtag ADHD Aquarius, and buys new lights. So every year new lights come in, and very few lights end up going out. And I mean, I've got lights on my deck. I've got lights everywhere. I'm getting close to being able to do the whole roof. But of course, that's only going to happen if he gets up there and does the whole roof. Because you know how I feel about outside. There's wind and it's cold and it might rain and
you could fall off the roof, and that's not what you want.
Yeah. Well, that's not what I want. I'm not saying it's not what others want, but it's definitely not what I want.
All right, where do y'all stand on fruitcake?
Yuck.
What about you, Max?
Makes an excellent doorstop. I mean,
talking the nasty kind with the brightly colored candied fruit?
Well, I mean, yeah. You know, this is a big deal in Britain. They like it. Princess Diana and Kate Middleton both served it at their weddings. Fruitcake.
But right? Those are British people. That's a tradition, a British tradition that they brought to us. I don't hate it. My mother used to get the fruitcake and then eat some of that. That's good. That's fruit. Oh yeah. Then she would make these cookies that were like fruitcake cookies. So the problem was they looked just like the chocolate chip cookies. Imagine the disappointment when you bite in and find out it's that nasty bright colored candy fruit and not chocolate chips.
I just don't like fruitcake. I'm not a hater. Like I want everyone else who likes it to absolutely like build yourself a house out of it. It has a weird freaking taste, like an aftertaste. You know that aftertaste.
It does have an aftertaste. It does.
And Lamar,
now, I've had some people that actually cooked it fresh, but we always got a Claxton. I'm assuming that's nationwide. Claxton fruitcake.
Oh, yeah.
From Claxton,
those
Georgia.
Those are legends, yep.
Yep, Claxton, yeah, Claxton fruitcake.
You're just such a man of many enigmas and mysteries because you're over here going, I got no Christmas sweater. I ain't drinking any eggnog. Yeah, I'm not going to kick a fruitcake out of bed. What?
I mean, I don't go buy it, but if I walk by a little buffet or something or a little party and somebody's got fruitcake, I'm like, yeah, I'll eat it. It's funny because when you talk about that being fruit, that is fruit like those plastic apples in the bowl is fruit. I mean,
exactly. For the longest time, like most of my life, because we all grew up with parents and grandparents who were like, it's fruitcake. Try it. You'll like it. It's good. Kids will eat anything, right? Yeah. For most of my adult life, every holiday season, somebody pushes some fruitcake at me. And I think to myself, this is the one. This is the fruitcake that's going to make me like fruitcake. This is the year I turn the fruitcake corner. And instead, I find myself gacking it into a napkin like a cat with a hairball. Like, no.
I don't run across this very often. Cookie swaps. I can remember this years ago, but I hadn't seen it in a while. Do you know what a cookie swap is? I'm assuming
you do. You show up at a party and everybody brings like a batch of homemade Christmas cookies and you put them all out on the table and then everybody goes around and fills their tin so that you don't have to make a zillion different kinds of Christmas cookies. Like maybe you make snickerdoodles and somebody else makes gingerbread men, but everybody ends up with a great big variety, right? That's a cookie swap.
Yep. The lady that wrote a book, The Cookie Party Cookbook, Robin Olson says that she found references when she did studies of cookie parties, is what they called them then, dating back to the late 1800s. Then they began to be called cookie exchanges by the 1930s, and then by the 50s it changed to cookie swaps. And it's always been like a ladies-only event, like ladies getting together, you know, whatever. I wish I could run up on a good cookie swap because I'd like to have some different cookies.
Lamar on the 17th, it's not a cookie swap, but my girls and I do a thing every year where we bake a bunch of different cookies and then we invite friends to come decorate them. And then you get to take home whatever cookies you decorate it.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Would you like to do that? You're a man.
But
we'll allow it. Yeah, we'll allow it. You want to come and decorate cookies? You can bring Carla.
I do like
that. you can bring Darby the dog. Yeah. All right. I don't want you to feel excluded.
Right. Oh my gosh. No, it's true. I think I'm going to keep that on my, because I love a bunch of different Christmas cookies. I really do. And we always talk about this, the 12 days of Christmas. You know, it goes for those 12 days from what? It goes what? December 25th to January the 6th?
Or January does
it go
from, 5th. It goes.
I mean 5th. Okay.
Because the 6th is the Feast of the Epiphany. And January 5th is 12th night.
Yeah. You know, I love that. I love it. When you grew up, we did, when you had choir practice at school or whatever, you blew it. We grew up singing that, and I was always visualizing all the stuff or whatever. And I think we went over this sometime in the last couple of weeks on the show, but the thing I come up with says that for this year – $46,730 would be what it would cost if you bought them all. So
that's a lot of birds.
I do enjoy it. I do enjoy it. I really do. I think it's one of those things. It's not Christmas without it. Now, how are you on poinsettias? You like poinsettias?
I do, but I have pets, and I think they're poisonous.
They're not good for them.
Oh yeah. That is true. But you know, these came from Central America, and they're brought to the United States by U.S. Ambassador to Mexico, Joel Roberts Poinsett. So I guess he gets to name the flower since he brought it in back in 1820. And now, 100 years later, they're everywhere. And you know, if we're going to somebody's house and we can't think of something else to bring, we stop and buy a poinsettia because you never make anybody mad at Christmas bringing a poinsettia. I mean, you just don't.
I've never known a situation where anybody said, oh, if I get one more poinsettia in this house.
If I'm not mistaken, they're saying it is the number one best-selling potted plant in the nation.
So I'm going to do something that I shouldn't do because it's something Bob does and we always yell at him because he doesn't submit his questions in writing ahead of time. But I'm having this weird feeling, like a tickle on the back of my brain going, didn't poinsettias used to be used for something else before they evolved into a Christmas plant? Didn't they have another meaning?
Now, that's a great question.
Max, don't you have the vague notion that they do?
I'm not surprised if it is, because I'm like you. There's a tickle, but I didn't run across it when I was doing this.
There's a part of you that's going, what else were they? Like, they started out as ... Anywho, what's next?
Last but not least is the Salvation Army bell ringers. You know, we don't think about them, but we see them all the time, and it just sort of goes in passing. I don't think you think about it. They have been collecting money for the needy since 1891. The tradition started in San Francisco when the Salvation Army Captain Joseph McPhee wanted to raise some money to offer a free Christmas dinner to 1,000 of the city's most destitute. And he was inspired by this kettle he had seen in England in which people tossed coins for the poor. So he set up his own version, and it quickly spread across the country. The Salvation Army helps more than 4.5 million people during the holiday season. And they don't only accept cash nowadays. You can make donations by smartphone. And
that's smart because nobody's got cash, right?
Yeah, nobody's got cash. So that's exactly right. I got a friend of mine that goes camping with us. His name is Terry. And he got a Grinch costume this year. And he's been running around with his Grinch costume. So he had volunteered to ring the bell. And he did it in the Grinch costume. Oh, my God.
I love it.
He took in tons because he really got into it. And it was really cool.
And that's such a great idea. I love it.
See, it changes everything. So, but that's just a few of the many traditions that we have. And I have certainly enjoyed us talking about it. And hopefully, I'm going to find me a sweater and get me some eggnog. So when we crank the tree up, I'll be ready. That's going to have to do it for this episode of Talking Lamar. Now, all of you are educated on the histories of a few of our great traditions. I hope you will not only share the information you learned with others, but tell them where you got it. You got it from Talking Lamar. We'll see you next time.
Thank you so much for listening to Talking Lamar, the Oddcast, and the Bob and Sherry Podcast. We would really love it if you would subscribe, rate and review, and share it with a friend on Facebook, Instagram, wherever you go. And thank you again for listening.